Thank you again for inviting me here to be with you these past few days. The 13th and 14th chapters of Acts tell of Paul and Barnabas' first preaching trip. On this trip, they were sent out by the church at Antioch, and when they completed this trip, they came back to the church at Antioch after revisiting the churches that they had established. On their way back, they set elders in place in all the churches that they had established. Read carefully the last part of the 14th chapter and you'll read about that. It's God's will that there be elders in each church. It's not a sin to not have elders if you don't have men qualified. But the Scripture teaches that it's His will for us to have elders in each church. And so, as you mature men, you need to appoint them. I want to congratulate you on having elders in the church here now, and I hope it'll always be that way. I would also caution you, don't appoint men that are not qualified just so you can have them, because that would be just as much as a disaster. So again, God has told us how to run things, but my point is, when He finished His work, Paul and Barnabas, when they finished it, they came back to Antioch and told them what God had done with them. That's what I'm doing here this morning. You helped to support me in Cape Town, South Africa, in India. I made my 51st trip there earlier this year. I've been there 31 years. And, of course, I'm working in a lot of other countries. I've worked in more than 20 different countries. And in preaching, I've made over 100 trips overseas in the last 40 years in behalf of Christ and His way of life. I said all that to say that's why we're following apostolic pattern when we come back and tell the church what God has been doing with us. By now, you have a copy of my latest report. It came out, I believe, March the 1st. Shortly after I arrived back home from India. You might be interested in knowing I write these reports in India. It's the last piece of work I do in India before I get on the plane to fly home. I do that because I've got 6 weeks of mail to go through when I get home, and I wouldn't have time to report it after I get home. I take a day off just before I leave India, and all day long I work on this report. Anyway, that's just a little bit of the mechanics of my work. Some people say, Russell, we know what you do in India, but what do you do in this country? Well, I have 5 gospel meetings this year, 1 last week, this one this week, another one in Cape Town, South Africa, a 4-night meeting in the middle of our door-knocking campaign there. That begins June the 8th and ends July the 1st. I'm taking 11 workers with me, and we'll be knocking doors, setting up Bible studies, and teaching them. These 11 workers, I'll be training them every morning for about 30 minutes before we go out and have a devotional. And there'll be a devotional each evening, and there'll be teaching or setting studies morning, afternoon, and night. We have 1 day off in that middle of that. And we was requested to take that day off because it's a holiday in that country, and they said people would see it as an intrusion if we came on that holiday. So that's kind of like the work is laid out there. Then I return to India the 29th of July. I'll be there until September the 1st when I'll fly to Myanmar. We know better as Burma. I'll be teaching preachers there until the 12th, and then I fly back to the U.S. They passed a new law in India. Once you leave the country, you cannot return to India for 2 months. So when I fly out of India to Myanmar, I then will fly back to Chennai, where I always land and where I always take off to go back to the U.S., but I won't be allowed back in the country there. So I've got to schedule my flight to land there to be in a transit area till I can board another plane back to Frankfurt and then this time to Houston, and then to Kansas City. Anyway, it's getting more complicated all the time, but as I was talking with Doug before this service started, a good travel agent takes care of all that. All they do is tell you how much to write a check for, and it's finished. So don't think that I'm a genius on working out paths. I just tell them what I want, and they maybe talk to me about it and call me back, and we talk some more. And you know, this past month, we've been talking quite a lot because it is a real mixed-up thing because of that new law in India. I don't like taking two big bags into Myanmar, but I have to do that because I won't be allowed back in India, and there's no place I can leave a bag. They're afraid you have a bomb in it or something. So it's just everything is touchy world over about air travel. There's a lot of new rules. Anyway, that's some of the mechanics and some of the things I do. When I'm in country in Topeka, I answer letters. You ever noticed how Paul did his business? Exactly the same. I pattern my work after the Apostle Paul. In fact, I've been referred to in newspaper articles as 21st century Apostle Paul, because I patterned so close to the way he did business. He would go into a village, teach and baptize, form churches, and always had someone he could leave with them or raise a man up to the point where he could lead that church before he moved on to another one. Then he wrote letters back to those churches, and they wrote letters to him, and then he revisited those churches, and also he sent other preachers back to preach at those places. We follow all of those patterns. I want you to notice one other thing, and this one is a sour note with many people. Paul never sent money back to one church that he started. He sent them responsibility. He would say, I'm going to send Timothy and maybe someone else back to you. You meet their needs while they're with you. So he gave them responsibility, not money, the churches he established. Look through the New Testament. Find one place where he sent money back to them. The only occasion where he did that was a natural disaster, and he would collect money and send it back to them, like when they had a famine, you remember. Don't misunderstand me. It's good to do things for others. There's no violation to do help people with different needs they have and things like that. But my point is this. To put preachers in other countries on salary is really not taught. Is it okay to do that? Yeah, I don't think you're violating any scripture, but every missionary for the past 200 years said it's one of the worst mistakes we've made is putting nationals on support or the natives that you're working with. The reason why, if you stop their support, they say, what have I done wrong? You say nothing, but the church teaches, you know, the scriptures teach very clear. Read carefully 1 Corinthians, the 9th chapter, verse 1 through 14. And you'll see that Paul says a preacher has a right to pay. But the pay is to come from those he sows the spiritual things to him, or the church that he is teaching and preaching for. I said that in a church once, and the preacher says, well, then if we're going to have an exit strategy, when do we start cutting back on your help? And I said, well, mine's a little bit different. They continued to send Paul money because he was working here and there, but sometimes he worked making tents and paid his own way. And I teach them this. You need to learn. You know, I teach preachers. That's my audience most of the time. Most places I go now, preachers are my audience. That's why I don't baptize near as many as I used to, because you can't baptize preachers. They're already baptized, and that's my audience. But, I tell them, your pay needs to come from the ones you're preaching for. So, you can work at another job, support yourself like Paul did, or you can receive money from other churches to support you while you're doing the preaching. But you should have an exit strategy in every piece of mission work you take up. For example, there's a church in Knoxville, Tennessee that supports the Aurangabad Bible College that Gene Renault and I established about 10 or 12 years ago. Well, their exit strategy is this, and it's a good exit strategy. They pay $50 a month for each student in the school, and 15 new students start each year there. It's a two-year school, and so after the second onslaught, there's 15 more students come on, and they're the second-year students. But the students, each one, sign a contract that says, I'll receive $50 a month while I'm a student in the school for 2 years. And then I'll receive $50 a month the first 2 years I'm out of school. After that, I'm on my own. Now, that will force them to become self-supported churches. We say there's different ways you can handle that. You can get a job to where you work, and also you preach and help churches to develop. Either that or your wife can work and help support you and begin to preach on giving, begin to teach and baptize others. The more you bring in, the more money is going to be in the collection so that they can pay your salary. But the exit strategy to that is, after 4 years, each student is on his own. Now, it's going to continue as long as they run that school because there will be 15 new students coming on. But there's an end to each one of them's support. But one of the ways that was patterned is the same way in this country when I was a missionary. I went to Okanagan, Washington, the first church after I graduated. It was made up of 10 people. Well, the church that I asked to help support my wife and I was a church in Kansas City. And I said, if you'll support us for 1 year, and then after 1 year, please cut back 20%. And we'll persuade the church there to agree to take up 20% of our salary. After 2 years, another 20%, until after 5 years, they would be sending nothing. The local church would be paying our salary. Now, that put a lot of pressure on my wife and I. But it was self-imposed. I was the one that put this program together because I believe a church should be self-supported. After 5 years, the attendance was then about 75, and as a result, they were paying our full salary, and we were self-supported. We did that at the second place we went to. A church in Broken Arrow, Oklahoma, supported us in the same way, the same form. Same way at the third church. And so this is not new to me. That my 25 years in local work was with three churches, and each one went from a few people to a self-supported church. Brother Bailey recruited me to work in India and said, Russell, we want you to teach the Indians how to have self-supported churches just like you have done in this country. And so that's what I went to India for. He recruited me in 1979. And I don't know if you know it or not, but he asked me to see to the work before he died. In fact, the last several years, the eldership of the Weyburn Saskatchewan Church of Christ in Canada, they have sent me $2,500. When he could no longer go, they began to send that to me each year, and they still send that to me. Last summer, they asked me to come up and teach the adult section of the Vacation Bible School and bring some young people with me to help them put on a Vacation Bible School. I taught in the Vacation Bible School 2 sessions a day with the adults and baptized 2 that week, a Mormon and an Episcopalian. And it's the first baptisms they had had in a while. All I'm saying is wherever I am, I evangelize or help people to know Jesus and obey Jesus. Whether it's at home, whether it's in America, whether it's in another country. I believe in churches being self-supported, as you are here. And the only way I know to do it is for a man to work like Paul did, part-time. But although he worked part-time, he also took wages of the church. We find that in 2 Corinthians, I believe, the 11th chapter. I robbed other churches, taking wages them that I might preach to you. That's basically what I'm doing now, robbing other churches with Paul's words so I could preach in Asia, in Africa, and many other places. To give you some idea of the things that I do overseas, I want to tell you about some, I believe this class ends at 9:10:15, is that correct? All right. Look at the statistics for just completed work in India. I presented 70 lessons in 6 weeks. I preach every day when I'm in India. We have no days off. Because of the expense to get there and to get back, we like to make we need to use every bit of time we can. And so we do that. An average of a lesson or two every day. We preach morning, afternoon, and evening. Some's in travel, and so we have to preach three lessons some days to keep that up. I saw 142 baptized during that 6 weeks. Now, you might say, if you're teaching preachers most of the time, how you baptized 142 people? Well, let me tell you. I had two evangelistic meetings. And when I say two, I had one that lasted 3 days. During those 3 days, I spoke in, I believe it was 9 different churches. In those 9 different churches, we baptized 42. Another group of meetings was 5 meetings over 4 days, one each day except for one. We preached 2 that one afternoon and one evening. But these evangelistic meetings, we baptized 67. So you can see in those 3 days here and 4 days here, did most of the baptizing on this trip. Now, these evangelistic meetings were made up of a man that called M. Davis Sagayam that preaches in Arconum, and I'll tell you a little bit about a meeting I had there this year. But he's a teacher at National Bible College, but he always arranges an evangelistic meeting for me that lasts usually 3 days, sometimes two, but we'll be preaching morning, afternoon, and evening, and he will set the schedule. I'll rent a car, and we will travel to those places. I preach. He gives an exhortation at the end of it, and he also translates my lesson into either Tamil or Telugu. That's the two languages in the area we're evangelizing. Up in the other place where we had these 5 meetings over 4 days was at Aurangabad Bible College. And I would lecture twice there in the morning, and I usually have a partner with me, and he would lecture twice. And then by 1 o'clock, we'd be through, we'd eat lunch, and then we would have an evangelistic meeting in the afternoon someplace. Most of these meetings had about 300 in attendance. Most of them were tent meetings or something that was put up for us there, but it was where the church met, but they made it bigger, maybe an open place where we would preach. Let me just tell you about one of those special meetings. So you'll get an idea, maybe have a word picture of what these meetings are like. Arrived on the scene, and there was a big tent had been put up, and there was about 300 people sitting on either rugs or blankets or something around on the ground in front of the podium. I preached for probably 45 minutes or so, and when an invitation was offered, we don't sing an invitation song like you do here, Curry, but what we do is say, if anyone wants to take baptism, raise their hand. And 16 hands went up there. You know, it's a wonderful experience to see that. Well, after that happened, then the preacher came to the microphone and spoke in their language, telling them how to get to the place where we were baptized and where it was going to be. This time it was going to be in his yard where a baptistry had been put together. The baptistry was a water tank about this long and about this wide. Usually it sets on top of a house and then gravity carries the water down to the faucets, but the tank usually sets on the roof. But the top had been cut out of this tank, and it was just a thick plastic, and a chair was put beside it, and another metal chair inside where they could get into it. It was a pretty long step, but they was able to manage with some help. Anyway, the people then moved up there. We hired a couple of three-wheelers. I don't, maybe you've seen them on the news before. They're a little car-like thing that you pull a crank just like a lawnmower to start them. And there's a back seat, and usually two or three people ride back there, but we put about 12 back there in each one and got them to this place that was about 3/4 of a mile away where the baptisms took place in his yard. As the baptism began, the procedure begins, you know, people changing clothes and doing things like that. I always work my way to kind of the back of the place where I can kind of observe what's going on. I never do the baptizing. An Indian preacher, a local preacher, usually does the baptizing. And as he got ready and they began to line up, he took confessions, and then one by one they entered the water and he baptized them. During this process, there was a young lady standing beside me. I didn't know from anyone. And we began to talk a little bit and found out she was a college student in her senior year, about 22 years old. As a man was being baptized, she said, "That's my younger brother." So then that made me ask her, "Have you been baptized?" She said, "No." And that's all that was said. "Do you wonder why she had not been baptized?" I said, "Do you go to church here?" And she said, "Yes." So, you know, this was a natural thing in all except her brother was being baptized, 3 or 4 years younger than her. He was probably 18 or 19, and she was not baptized. But she was very joyous that he was being baptized. Does anyone know why she wasn't baptized? Do you have an idea? Because she's not married. It's difficult to get a girl married if she's a Christian. And you might think that's backwards, but remember, probably her parents went to church there, and they would pick a husband for her that would be friendly to the church and one they thought would probably become a Christian. They might even insist that he become a Christian before they're married. They might even be baptized together before they're married or after they're married. But anyway, that's just kind of like part of the culture there. And because of that, you know, not only are 95% of the marriages arranged, in fact, maybe even a higher percent than that, but also parents have to buy husbands for their wives. The dowry is that direction. Now, they do this, and the more educated man you get for your daughter, the more you pay for him. Now, maybe pay doesn't sound right to you and stuff, but basically that's what it amounts to. We're trying to get that dropped in Christians, but, you know, there's some still practice it and so on. Anyway, let me tell you what else I discovered in that meeting. Another lady, probably 22 or 23 years old, she says, "This is my mother. We're being baptized today. And this is my grandmother. She's being baptized today." Have any of you preachers ever baptized 3 generations at one service? Well, that was my first time as far as I know. It may have been done and I just didn't know. But here we baptized a grandmother, a mother, and a daughter, all of them grown. So I just happened to discover that and I thought it was really interesting. But among the 16 was 3 generations there. This boy that was in college, and probably in the future, his sister will be baptized. Different countries have customs, even though you... Let me tell you this part. You'll like this. We have an orphanage there called Sister Patricia's Orphanage. We have 90 children there. We started with a half a dozen children. I told him that 40 is the limit. We couldn't support more than that. We didn't have room for more than that. But today we have 90. Would you like to know how a number changed from 40 to 90? He said to me, when I scolded him and said, "Why are you bringing children in here when we can't take care of the ones we've got? I told you 40 was the limit." He said, "Sir, what am I supposed to do when they're left on our doorstep in the midnight hour?" What can you say?
Nothing.
Anyway, that's how the number went above my plan. We can make plans, but sometimes we have to alter them. But the reason I brought that in here, I just sent $2,000 to the orphanage. It was above what I usually send them. We usually send them $20 per child per month. And we send it quarterly, and so they get a pretty good sized check. I think it's between $5,000 and $6,000 four times a year. But I had to send another $2,000. A $2,000 I didn't have. But $1,500 of it was three of our girls that were grown enough that they were getting married. We pay for their weddings $500 each. That buys her and the groom clothes, wedding clothes, and it also pays for a dinner at the wedding and for everyone that comes. We only marry our girls to men that are members of the church. That's a prerequisite. There is no exception to that. So the marriage starts out a man and a woman that are both Christians and have a good start in life that way. That isn't according to the custom I told you earlier about this girl wouldn't be baptized until she was married. In those five meetings at Aurangabad Bible College, I baptized, 16 at three of those meetings, 16 each, 12 at another, and 7 at another, totaling 67 in those 4 days of five meetings. Anyway, that answers the question. I want you to remember that a good part of my time, especially in the fall, is in February, we have graduation at three different Bible colleges that Jean Renault and I established. The earliest one was National Bible College in Chennai. A city of 12 million people. Aurangabad is a city of about 2 million people, but one of the things that makes it important, it's our only school of preaching in the Marathi language. Now, National Bible College is English medium. We have students there that represent about 10 different languages, but the common language is English. And then they can go home and preach in 10 different languages after their graduation. Most of our students in National Bible College come out of the North or Myanmar or Nepal or another bordering Bangladesh or one of the bordering countries. So it's really an international school now. And most of the students, if you look at... Did I pass those pictures? No, I forgot to pass them around. Here's the graduates of National Bible College, and I think you've seen them from, and this is from North India Bible College in Chandigarh. And if you would look on your map over in the room you eat in, you would see that National Bible College is almost as far south as you can go in India, and North India Bible College is up near the Himalayas, about as far north as you could go in the country. So we really have good schools in the north and in the south, and Aurangabad's more towards the center of the country. And all three are in three different languages, and so it's real important. Hindi, the more national language of the country, is what North India Bible College is taught in. It's in Punjab State, and Chandigarh is like our Washington, D.C. It's a state in itself. The city is just like Washington, D.C. is. So it's a very important city, but very expensive. We're thinking very serious of moving out maybe 40 or 50 miles to a village where it still would center around Chandigarh, but wouldn't be so expensive. To buy even an acre of property in that city would be about $2 million U.S. dollars. That's how expensive the land is in that city. And so what it amounts to is I doubt if we'll ever be able to build our own building in that city. Anyway, that's some of the problems we're facing and working on. And North India Bible College has become a Bear Valley satellite school, and they're in charge of that. And they do some assisting, visit there, send teachers there, and things like that. But now that Gene Renault is dead, he and I used to arrange the graduation at these schools. Now that's on me. And I set the dates for all three, National Bible College, Aurangabad Bible College, and North India Bible College. I also provide a lectureship with each one, invite other Americans. Some come meet there and become part of the lectureship. Come right on in. And some of us, almost the whole month of February, about 3 weeks, is lectureships and graduations from one end of India to the other. I have to make about 7 to 10 flights to make all these different graduations and get back to the next place and so on. But, you know, all of those flights, 10 plane tickets to fly all over India during that time, I think last time cost me less than $700, all of them together. So it isn't a big amount of money, but it is an extra expense, and it's well worth it. The North India Bible College draws preachers from about 10 or 11 states that come there for our 2 days of lectures and graduation. Anyway, I told you I might give you a little time for question and answer, and we only have about 3 minutes left. I didn't do near all I wanted to do, but I knew that coming in I wouldn't get a chance to. I do want to draw your attention on the second page, the back side, where it says 2011 Indie Evangelism Projects. This is $95,000 worth of stuff that we do every year. One of the great things we do is we buy 10,000 Bibles in 7 different languages and ship them to good churches and preachers for the Church of Christ all over India. Almost every state has their own language. And so we think a new Christian, has a right to a Bible in his language or her language when they become Christians. And so we buy these 10,000 Bibles to put them in the hands of new Christians. Also, I have printed 10,000 Telugu songbooks with over 400 songs in each one every year and give these freely as well. 400 sets of communion supplies, very similar to what you have here on the table. When the men graduate from the School of Preaching, we give them a communion tray with cups in it, and they're permanent cups that you could stand on and they wouldn't break. A bread tray, and a collection stick. A collection stick is a stick about that long with a bag hanging on it. The reason these are necessary is because when they take a collection, there are not pews to pass down a basket through here, but people are sitting all over the place and there's no aisles. So men can take their baskets and with their arm and another stick about as long as their arm can reach almost anyone in the audience as one moves from either side through the crowd. So that's what a collection stick is. A factory in India makes these communion trays and bread trays and collection sticks, and we can provide the three of them together for about $20 each. Anyway, that's some of the things I do. Everywhere we preach, some preachers come, they line up behind our van, and they say, I need a communion tray, I need a collection stick. Whatever they need, we try to provide. They need a few songbooks. They'd like to have 100, we give them maybe 10. But anyway, it's like that. Even making 10,000 songbooks a year, it's not enough. That's some things that we do, and then I ate up your question and answer time, so forgive me. I'd take one question.
You answered my question in a way, what the collection stick was.
Okay, we took care of that. Thank you very much. You've been a good class.